This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you with us on our virtual Main Street across North Dakota, our radio Main Street for the state. Today is a special day, too, because we've finished the first week in April, and it's time to convene the Editor's Roundtable. And today, as usual, we have Dave Thompson, our news director, in our studio in Bismarck. Hello, Dave.
Hey there, Doug.
And with you, Steve Andrist. He's the executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association. Hello, Steve.
Hey, how's everything?
Hunky damn dory, as I occasionally say. And with me in studio, Matt Von Pannon. He's the editor of the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead. Matt, a pleasure to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Doug.
We're going to start with a very serious subject and a very unusual one for our state, this mass murder, multiple murder in Mandan. And we have somebody who's under arrest, Dave.
We certainly do. A chiropractor by trade from Washburn was arrested last night shortly after 7 o'clock in the evening, I think. So they had a 9 p.m. news briefing last night to talk about the arrest. The person has this, Chad Isaac, has been charged with two murder class AA felonies. And class AA means that would be life in prison without parole if found guilty. Mm-hmm. Again, this is just a charge that's being leveled, but he was arrested in Washburn and apparently living in a mobile home park up there that probably was managed by RJR where the murders took place. There's still a lot of things we don't know at this point.
But surveillance video apparently played a role.
It did. Not only surveillance video from RJR, but also from nearby Midway Lanes and a couple other businesses. There are car dealers there that have video cameras, so they looked at all that footage.
Steve, what's your take on this event?
Well, what a tragedy. It's, as you said, it's something that we're not used to seeing in North Dakota happen at all, and it's unfortunately becoming more commonplace all across the country. Hopefully, this does turn out as expected to be kind of an isolated thing, but I think we're so unused to this sort of thing happening here that what we saw, particularly in the Mandan community, is a lot of people just eager and clamoring for information about what was happening. You know, they were assured from the beginning that there was no danger to the public. On the other hand, they didn't have any information to suggest why that is. So
yeah.
I think there's a lot of social media blather and a lot of discussion in the coffee shops and across the region about are we really safe and what really happened here and how much do we deserve and need to know?
And I will just jump in and say that over the last days, since it happened Monday and today is Friday, you're talking about a span of 5 days. I think I've heard about 60 different theories from 60 different people.
Uh-huh. Well, that is the concerning issue, though, that, you know, the police have to say something. But when you say that there shouldn't, the community shouldn't be worried, that does raise a lot of issues, I think, that, well, do they know, they obviously know something we don't know, but I guess we want to know what it is.
Well, there's a reason why investigative information is exempt from open records laws. But there's also a fine line that law enforcement needs to walk in order to make sure they're providing the public with enough information to be able to be assured that things are going the way they should. And you know, they can exempt a lot of information or withhold a lot of information if it's investigatory in nature, but they don't have to. So that's a difficult decision. And, of course, being members of the media, we generally think that that they should be more forthcoming than they think they should be. And in this case, I think a lot of members of the public agreed with us.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's follow up on that as the evidence presents itself in the subsequent trial or as the case unfolds. But a very sad day for Mandan and for the state of North Dakota. This got national attention, after all. It was on the national news.
It certainly didn't. Somebody asked me about if I can remember an incident like this. And I have to go back to the Neugebauer case, and that was in the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where the teenager killed five members of his family.
Yeah.
And that was a case, and you know, that's been revisited a number of times. But really, these types of mass killings do not happen very often in North Dakota.
Well, I remember one in Minnesota's Lake Country on Sauk Lake 20-some-plus years ago that involved a family that was literally murdered by a next-door neighbor on the lake, and I think it might have been an issue over whether or not they were using his dock or something like that. And the only survivor was one of the daughters who was spending – was overnight at somebody else's place. So these things happen, and they are shocking when they do. Well, let's move to our side of the state here for a moment and talk about the flood fight. Matt, we have the perfect melt, I guess, so far.
We do. We do have the perfect melt and very lucky here, but we're not out of the woods yet.
A lot of people aren't, yeah.
And Cass County is reminding everyone that we don't have this beat, and there's a lot of rural areas that are experiencing some pretty significant flooding. In fact, today, you know, the National Guard was deployed. 10 members of the National Guard are going to be helping in the rural part of the county, and especially the area just north of Fargo, near Harwood and just west in Mapleton, and kind of if you drew a triangle between Mapleton and Harwood and Fargo, there is a vast lake. They call it the Vast Lake, but it's where the Rush and the Cheyenne are breaking out and trying to get to the Red just north of Fargo, and it just creates a massive body of water, and it's very hard to get around. And they've told the residents in and around Harwood that this is sort of their last chance to either get in or get out.
Wow.
And to be prepared to be, if you know, if they're at their places, they could be there a week.
Wow.
Without any access to, to, you know, whatever, medicine or whatever they might need. So they're just telling people, get ready and this could last a while.
And your paper also reported that they've been moving barriers and sandbags to the Lemoore area to help against the James River there.
Right. There's obviously some concern in that area. A lot of snow down there. And, you know, the James River has experienced some flooding in South Dakota, and I think it's just starting to kind of present itself in North Dakota a little bit too, because as we know, the thaw has sort of been moving north, and that stuff's starting to break loose and get going.
And this has been a national story now for some time because Nebraska has been largely underwater. There have been interstates there inundated. The Missouri River has been breaking levees along a lot of its stem north of Kansas City. So this is getting to be an epic flood year, even though we're breathing a modest sigh of relief here in the Fargo Moorhead area.
There's a little bit of concern. You know, we're expecting on the Red to crest sometime Sunday. It looks like Sunday evening now by the latest projections, but cresting still at 35 feet, which still is a top 10 flood in Fargo Moorhead history. We've had a lot of floods. So, you know, we look at that flood 10 years ago of just over 40 feet. And, you know, we compare ourselves to that now, but, you know, in the last 15 years, a 35-foot flood is a big flood.
Yes,
here.
It is.
And so while people are feeling somewhat relieved, we do have some potential rain moving in over the weekend. Could even rain here today a little bit. And the Weather Service this morning said that we could get some rain, you know, middle of next week, that could be fairly significant, a half an inch to an inch of rain. And obviously, if the water's high when that happens, then that creates a little bit of uncertainty about what that's going to do to the rivers.
And the forecast indicates that we won't be going below freezing, actually, for
right.
a few days.
Yeah,
here.
It's moving now. I mean, it's moving, and starting today, it doesn't look like anything's going to slow it down. So,
but the idea of these precipitation events, talking to General Dorman of the National Guard, he said that's the thing that people really have to keep a watch on. If they're talking, you know, thunderstorms potential for, you know, the next couple of days, especially Saturday night and Sunday, if you get heavy rain, well, all bets are off. So that's one thing you have to worry about.
And Danielle just reported about the this ice jam on the Yellowstone near the Missouri in your end of the state, basically. Mm-hmm. That's something we always worry about here because the flood flows, the Red River flows north.
Right. And if you take a look at the Yellowstone, it kind of flows northeast into the Missouri, and the confluence is near Williston. And that is a place where they do have a lot of ice jams. And I did happen to see some video from the National Weather Service about some of the ice jams in the Yellowstone, the big chunks of ice there. And they had areas that had never seen flooding or hadn't seen flooding for years actually saw water because of the ice jams. That's one thing that really nobody really can control.
And, of course, everybody has to cast their eyes north now, you know, from Hendrum north to Grand Forks, and eventually it all goes to Winnipeg and Lake Winnipeg. So the flooding season is not over. It's moving, as Matt mentioned.
One of the things, Doug, that we're watching intently here is we have some new flood walls going through right through the middle of the city, and those were, you know, completed last year.
Like Grand Forks has.
Right. And they're not quite to the heft that Grand Forks has, but they're running through our downtown, and just yesterday they put the gates up, and it looks like that those could have some water on them during this flood. So in the past, we've always built these emergency clay levees along right down through downtown. And so everybody's kind of curious to see how these things, if they work, and to what degree they'll work. So, but it looks like they'll get tested at least to some degree this time.
Well, it's really changed the look of downtown when you get close to the river, just as it did in Grand Forks, because these are massive dikes where there used to be, you know, rolling riverbank and lots of water at certain times of the year. Well, we have our Editor's Roundtable underway, and we've got Dave Thompson, and we've got Steve Andrist in Bismarck, and Matt Von Panon with me in Fargo, and we'll be back with more of this discussion in just a moment.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Easter Seals, Goodwill, and The Inc., providing support for children, adults, and families in need across North Dakota, thanks to donated goods at their Goodwill retail stores. Learn more at esgwnd.org. Because a better community starts with you.
You know, Away with Words has really opened my eyes to a new way of looking at language. I used to be really caught up in rules and what is right and what is wrong. I just love the way that you guys look at words from a place of curiosity instead of criticism.
Our philosophy on language and more this week on Away with Words.
That's Away with Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's our Editor's Roundtable Day. So I've got Matt Von Panon, the editor of the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead, with me in Fargo. And Dave Thompson has with him Steve Andrist, the executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association. Let's move to the legislature. This is conference committee time, and the session, when I check the calendar, is supposed to adjourn in about 3 weeks, Dave.
That is correct, and they're trying to save some days in case they have to come back and do some budget adjusting. And, of course, there's also a proposal in the legislature that's still pending, waiting for a vote on it in the House, that says that the legislature can call itself back into session to deal with vetoes, and it wouldn't count against the 80 natural days that the Constitution provides for our legislature.
You, of course, have been doing these legislative review programs on Fridays on our radio network. And today you've got Senator Erin Oban.
Right. Senator Erin Oban, who really has a distinction. She's the only Democrat, I think, west of Highway 3. But she's been elected. She's been reelected in Bismarck, and she's a member of two pretty good committees, Education and Government and Veterans Affairs in the Senate. And she talks a lot about, you know, education and how that's fared in the session. And we did get into a little bit of a discussion about, should it be a 15-member board? Should it be two boards? Should it be three boards? Should it be four boards of higher education?
Well, where are we with that?
We're at the one board stage that looks like it might be going through. Governor doesn't like it. Governor's issued a statement saying that he doesn't think that's going to really solve problems. But those who support it say it's the people you get on the board and giving them enough time to delve into these issues. If you would expand the board, then you can do maybe three subcommittees of five each that would deal with every tier of colleges in the state. And remember, that also has to be voted on in next year's election.
Exactly.
Yeah, because it's just a resolution.
Right. It has to change the Constitution. And I think there are some members of the current members of the state board who think adding membership is a good answer to it, because they're pretty busy, and there's a lot to take care of. But we don't have a real strong history in recent years of the voters approving anything that comes out of the legislature related to higher ed governance.
True enough.
And it's a conundrum in a way, because the legislature is so focused on higher ed governance and the rest of the state seems to be saying, oh, you know, come on, there are other things going on.
But, you know, even you hear people like the chairman of the Board of Higher Education, Don Morton, talk about the potential for an initiative measure to go to a two-board system. And you've even heard the governor kind of mention that offhandedly, that there might be some kind of petition for that way. So I don't think you've heard the last of these multiple board systems yet.
Well, that's interesting, because that would be sort of doing an end around the legislature, you know, from another branch of government in a way. Aren't you saying the governor's going to whisper in somebody's ear, why don't you start an initiated measure?
Well, I don't necessarily think that, but I, you know, he has the bully pulpit. He can do that.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting wrinkle. Let's talk a bit about the state employee retirement plan, because this could be very important to all those workers in the state.
All right. This thing has been studied many times. And talk about legislative studies that keep going and going and going over a lot of the same ground. But the House has added a study to this retirement bill that would basically help the fund recover from what happened in 2008. And it would basically say we need to study for 2 years how to convert the plan from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan. And actually, at one point, the study would include having all university system employees go to a TIA-CREF plan and away from the current PERS plan. It could be a very interesting study. Studies in the past have shown that make the conversion would be expensive. And then there's some concern is that maybe a disincentive for people to come to work for state government by going to defined contribution instead of defined benefit.
Well, the Social Security is a defined benefit plan in a sense. And defined contribution plans require those people to be mindful about contributing. And that's one of the problems with it, because some people say, you know, I'm 30 years old, I'll wait. I'll throw in some money when I'm 40 maybe. So that's the complication with it.
Definitely the state employees, of which obviously there are many here in Bismarck, would prefer to have the safety of having a defined benefit. When it comes to their retirement. And I think the legislature, especially the Republican portion of it, which is obviously the biggest one, sees some value in potential reduced costs by going to the defined contribution system.
Dave, most businesses are. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask Dave and Steve if you know, does this apply to lawmakers?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it would, because they can opt in now, but it would be a defined contribution.
Well, the defined contribution has been sweeping the country since 401ks were introduced now decades ago, but the same issue keeps coming up. When I went to work for the state university system in Minnesota, I was given the option of opting for a defined benefit or a defined contribution plan. And because of my age at the time and because I needed to goose it, I went with the defined contribution. But that was a choice I had. It wasn't imposed.
Yeah, and I think that some legislators – or there is the opportunity for state employees to opt out of defined benefit and go to defined contribution. I think there is still an option.
Okay.
Well, is there any program that's defined benefit other than a government program?
It depends. There used to be some unions that actually had that, the Teamsters Union.
Yeah, and then we think about what happened with the Central States Pension Fund.
Well, that's just it, and that's what's happening with the state's pension mm-hmm. fund too. And this is a national issue, actually.
It is, and there was a resolution basically trying to get Congress to make that Central States Fund whole, because a lot of retirees, especially Teamsters, were working for places like UPS or Super Value stores, and they were driving truck. They retired with the expectation they were going to get X amount of dollars per month in their retirement, and now it looks like it might be half that. So I know it's called the Butch Lewis Act.
Yes.
We've done some reporting on that, and there's real concern on that.
Well, it gets to be – you get to retirement and half of what you were expecting isn't there. That could be a real eye-opener. let's talk about the actual pay plan that's in front of legislators as well. Dave, you reported earlier this week, just yesterday, that legislative leaders say state employee pay plan could speed up the end of the session.
Right. The two chambers were pretty much at loggerheads. The Senate was proposing a 2% raise the first year, 3% the second year. House went with a 2-2. And what the House did, and some people are saying, well, the House gave a little bit on this, and I think that's true. The House went with a 2% plan the first year, and they put a floor on it, and that's $120 a month, and a ceiling on that of $200 a month. That will help up, you know, the vast majority of state employees who are at the lower end of the scale. And then a 2.5% in the second year, and the Senate readily agreed to that because of the floors that were put in for the 2%. And if that sounds like a lot of numbers, it is.
Well, I think what the bottom line is the lower paid people who are state employees are going to get raises probably in excess of 2%.
Right.
And the higher paid employees, including judges, which we've heard a little bit of grumbling about, are going to be getting less than 2% because of the cap that's at $300.
Right. And there is a provision in the bill, or is there going to be a provision in the bill, that if a state agency has money left over, they can roll it up and give it for, you know, benefits or raises to the hired paid staff. But in the court system, I think that's a fairly lean budget, so there probably isn't a lot of money you can roll up.
Mm. Okay, so that remains to be determined, but it could mean that the session might end a little earlier if they can really get that passed and dealt with, right?
Yeah, that's what they're saying, but boy, there are a lot of sticky wickets left.
Of course there are.
What that does for them is it gives them an entree to approve all the state budgets because now they know what to plug in for salaries, so they can start kicking out the state budgets for each individual agency.
How many state employees are there roughly?
15,000 counting higher education.
That gets to be a pretty big budget item.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Let's talk briefly here about this income tax reduction plan that's been revived and added to the budget bill, Dave.
Remember, this was proposed by Representative Hedlund from Montpelier, North Dakota, who is chairman of the House Finance and Taxation Committee. He wanted to take about half the legacy fund earnings and put it in a fund to start buying down income tax, with the goal of getting income tax in North Dakota to zero. It passed the House. It failed miserably in the Senate because the Senate has a lot of people who believe in the three-legged stool of funding. And there was some grumbling that if you went for something like this, because the legacy fund is basically oil tax earnings, are you betting your future on a commodity that price kind of fluctuates a little bit? So there was some concern there. But it came back, and it's been amended, although the amendment has not yet been approved. It has been amended to the tax commissioner's budget. And this could be a nice bargaining chip when it comes to some conference committees.
Well, that's exactly it. What you're seeing here is two houses who are diametrically opposed on an issue. The House wants to get rid of income taxes. The Senate does not.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason this came back, I think most people would agree, is because it gives the House a bargaining chip mm-hmm. when it comes down to the nitty-gritty of what issues they're going to stand firm on in conference committees.
Well, I think a lot of people would say that three-legged stool has one very long leg called property tax.
Right. That's what we're hearing is just mm-hmm. that, you know, Of all the taxes to try to address, most people out there are more interested in property taxes than income tax.
So we'll wait to hear some conversation about that, I guess.
And you'll hear a lot of conversation about that, I think.
This is our Editor's Roundtable. We hold this once a month. That was Dave Thompson's voice. You just heard our news director, Matt Von Panon, before him. He's with the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead and Steve Andrist with Dave in Bismarck. Steve is the head of the North Dakota Newspaper Association. We will reconvene the roundtable after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Adjutant General of the North Dakota National Guard called it a bolt out of the blue contingency. General Alan Dorman asked and received permission to dip into state contingency funds to help fight floods around North Dakota, the amount $300,000. Dorman says the money is for unexpected situations. As an example, he pointed to the situation along the Yellowstone River, just upstream from the confluence with the Missouri River, with an ice jam.
Nobody thought that, you know, land that had never flooded in three or four generations was going to flood in a matter of hours. And we saw it in Minot in 2011. And again, the weather looks favorable. But an isolated thunderstorm that dumped a lot of water into a river basin, especially in the southeastern part of the state where there's still some snowpack there, that could be that bolt of the, out of the blue that we got to be prepared for.
Dorman and Cass County has asked for a quick response force of up to 10 soldiers to be ready on short notice to help in the flood fight. Also, the Department of Emergency Services has sent HESCO barriers and sandbags to Lemoore to help deal with James River flooding. The Senate has passed a bill that would allow second cousins to join family farms as part of the state's corporate farming law. Current law only allows parents, sons, daughters, stepchildren, grandparents, grandchildren, siblings, great-grandparents, aunts, uncles, and first cousins to join. Proponents of the bill say it's getting harder and harder to start a farm these days, and expanding the circle to include second cousins still keeps it in the family. Republican Senator Terry Wanzek says he thinks opening it up to second cousins would not threaten family farms.
What's happening, it's only very wealthy individuals who can continue to farm and grow in size, and we're restricting these opportunities. I don't think the second cousin is a threat to our family farms. You know, it offers a way or a means for younger people to get into agriculture. It's such a capital-intensive business. I mean, anybody even looking into establishing just a moderate-sized farm is going to spend millions to get it done. There's no way that I could, a young person today could start without somebody affiliated in the farming industry that's willing to bring them into the picture. It's almost impossible.
Senators who did not support the bill say this expansion is a foot in the door, and once that door is open, it can't be closed. Democratic Senator Jim Dotsenrod spoke against the bill. He says voters in North Dakota don't support corporate farming and won't likely support this expansion.
It's my view that this is an expansion and that we will set a precedent here. If we approve this, we will be setting a precedent for future expansions of our family farm corporation law. And it will be hard in the future to turn those down. If we grant this expansion at this time, I think we'll find in the future that other attempts to make it larger will be hard to turn down because we've set the precedent here that we're willing to expand it.
The Senate passed the bill on a vote of 35 to 11. And a bill that would divide the state into 19 human service zones is a step closer to fruition. The House passed the measure today on a 79-5 vote. The chairman of the House Human Services Committee, Hertzfield Republican Representative Robin Weiss, told the House this has been part of an evolution of delivery of human service programs.
And then in the last 10 years or so, there's been a push to continue that evolution of, because these are state-mandated services, and oftentimes they're not fair across individual counties, that we need to change the way we're doing business. Senate Bill 2124 does that. Completely changes the way we deliver services to our clients.
Weiss said there have been some pilot projects on service delivery through zones, and he says those have been very successful.
Showing up in this ability to forget about county borders, forget about county lines, and forget about maybe some of the turf wars that may happen or turf protections.
The bill will go back to the Senate to see if that body concurs with some House changes. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. It's our editor's roundtable. I've got Dave Thompson and Steve Andrist in Bismarck. Thanks, gents, for joining us, as usual. Mm-hmm. And with me, Matt Von Panon in Fargo. And we're talking about, the state legislature has got about 3 weeks left in the session. But we got some bullish news on the state's economy, Dave. Danielle reported on Monday that an economics professor at Creighton University, who often, you know, comments about the state of the economy in our part of the nation, says it's going pretty well for us.
Right. Now, Dr. Goss always surveys purchasing managers, and he comes up with this Mid-American Business Conditions Report. His index says anything over 50 looks good, and we're well over 50 again. And at times we've been over 60, but, you know, it's on the right track, and things are looking good. There's still a lot of jobs open in North Dakota. I mean, I heard the term again, 30,000.
Yeah, that's the one that seems to be hanging out there.
And I think one, just as a side note on this, we've got oil going up. And as a matter of fact, we can attest to you in Bismarck, the price of gasoline is now $2.69 a gallon. Yeah. as of today.
Well, I think here it's been $2.49, but I haven't looked out the window lately either. So at any rate, it's interesting because oil is certainly important to the state's economy right now.
Right. And the one concern still is agriculture because, you know, ag has been down for a few years. And really, we've been lucky we've had bumper crops in a lot of our commodities. But the prices aren't very good right now.
Yeah, the price of soybeans is a problem. And, of course, we've still got this ongoing trade discussion with China, and that is hanging out there and probably concerning some people as we get close to planting.
Right.
So the other piece here is that we had the Minneapolis Fed president, Neil Kashkari, was in town, and Todd McDonald covered that yesterday. He had a town hall at NDSU, and apparently he had the same thing to say.
He did. And, of course, what was one of his main things? What's holding North Dakota back is workforce. We don't have the workforce at this point. And I always find that very interesting, that we do have a situation where we've got a number of jobs open, and we're looking for some specialized jobs and have been unable to find employees to do that. They start moving around, and then, you know, they leave a job, and that leaves another job open.
Well, of course, you might be looking for greener pastures, you know,
that's
a better
true.
Wage. Better benefits, that kind of thing.
That's true.
Incentives.
Yeah, and I think he met with our editorial board too, and it was interesting to hear his perspective because he said that, you know, they expected for years and years they've expected a lot of older Americans to get out of the job market, but they're sticking in there longer. And he said, but the concern is really when those baby boomers decide to step out of the job market.
That would be me.
that will be, he said, a reckoning, and that it will create a whole different level of competition for the worker.
Ah, that is an interesting insight,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. It was very interesting for us because he sees a challenge on the horizon, and it's not very far away. And it's going to look at, you know, the challenges are going to get, in some ways, more severe.
Okay. So this is an important, I think, bit of insight here because the state has been wrestling with this employment issue
yes.
for quite a long time now. And there are, you know, there have been ideas suggested, but the legislature has been somewhat hesitant to go those directions.
And he also reiterated that, you know, he feels immigration is a big piece of the puzzle. So it was interesting because he's a Republican, but he felt strongly that immigration was very, very important to solving the workforce crisis.
Well, so. Tom Eason does these Plains Folk essays for us here on Main Street, and some time ago he did one that was a bit of an eye-opener where he reminded our listeners that at one point, not long after North Dakota became a state around the turn of the century, this was the most diverse state in the United States because of its immigrant population.
Interesting.
From all over the world.
And they've also, the data shows that had it not been for immigration, North Dakota would have seen fewer workers over the past 20 years. So the immigration into the state has actually kept the state where it's at. Had it not been for immigration, we'd be in a tougher crunch right now for employment.
Well, it's been a kind of a political whipping
really?
Boy, actually, for some time now. And that has, I guess, blurred some of the important issues because we do have immigration reform that should be done in this country. I mean, it's been pending for a long, 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 long time. But it gets caught up in these other things.
It is kind of interesting to see discussions at the legislature. They haven't done any overarching workforce legislation that I'm aware of this year. But workforce development shows up in all kinds of little nooks and cranny bills all over the place, whether it's dealing with allowing spouses of military people to be automatically grandfathered into licensure or expunging or sealing the records of people with minor drug offenses so that employers can't find out that they have these drug offenses. And it's all done under the idea that it would help our workforce.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a conundrum that North Dakota faces probably a more serious issue with this than most places in our nation. So work needs to be done, I guess. Let's talk a bit about this interesting family engagement cabinet story that you posted yesterday, Dave. Kristen Baszler, the state school superintendent, is talking about this. What does she mean by this?
Well, she said that, you know, often what happens is, you know, the first 5 or 6 years of a child's life, you drop them off at daycare or an early childhood education, and parents are very involved. They're consulted, and they're given lists of what their students are doing or the kids are doing. Then when they get to, you know, first grade, it's like the schools have, in many cases, have said, don't worry about it. We got this. And the parents feel like they're not as connected. So this is a way that Superintendent Baszler would like to see parents become more connected and more involved in their education after the kindergarten years.
Does she have any specific ideas in mind? I mean, what kind of involvement is she talking about?
Well, she doesn't have specific ideas, but she said, you know, there needs to be some, you know, opening up of dialogue between the, quote, education institutions and the parents. And she says that she's hoping that, you know, if you get about 20 to 25 people on this cabinet, you'll come up with some pretty good ideas. She said that's what happened when she set up the student cabinet, that a lot of students brought ideas, and those things are being hashed out too.
So is she looking to appoint this cabinet herself, or is there some process for selecting these people? How does it work?
You apply, and then there will be a selection process, and she hopes to select 20 to 25 people and maybe have the first meeting in Bismarck probably as soon as sometime in May.
Hmm. Well, education is a big deal, that's for sure. We spend a lot of money on it for public education, and families ultimately spend a lot of money on it for higher education as well. So although we used to be concerned about it in higher ed, about helicopter parents, you know, the ones who were standing behind their kid as they were being admitted to college and probably going to the dorm with them, you know, and coming every weekend and all that kind of stuff.
Calling the professor when they have a bad grade.
Yeah, exactly, yes. So I guess it's interesting. I thought the PTA was sort of this liaison function as well, but apparently, and Kristen Baszler is an expert in this area, she wants to see more.
Well, Not to diminish the effort at all, but just as kind of a sign of the times, I think there are. I'm a grandparent now, So I have grandchildren in elementary schools in Fargo and Bismarck, and there are plenty of opportunities for parents to be involved with what's going on in comparison to what there were when I was in elementary school, which was, I think, in effect, drop them off at the door and bring them back afterwards.
Yeah. Right, and to follow it further, I went to a parochial school. And we were dropped off at the door. And for some reason, if you got in trouble with the nun or the priest and you got wrapped on the knuckles with a ruler, you'd come home and say, hey, the teacher hit me with a ruler. And the answer inevitably was, what did you do?
Mm-hmm. Well, not to pull age on any of you, but I didn't get dropped off at school. I had to walk.
Both ways uphill.
That's yes, right.
That's right.
Detroit Lakes did have a hill. That's right. Let's talk about this Burgum license fee veto.
Oh, that's fascinating. The driver's license fees have not been raised since the 1980s, and I think 87 was when they raised it. And the bill in the legislature was go from $15 to $30. And that they would use the money, basically keep the money in the road fund.
Over a five-year period.
Over a five-year period,
so
right.
About $5 a year is the increase.
And then the governor vetoed it, saying, I've got this $22.5 million computer program that I want DOT to install and you guys to fund it. And that's going to help, you know, some efficiencies there. Now, where it gets kind of sticky to me is that I found out today that the $22.5 million was going to come out of what is called the SIF fund, the Strategic Investment and Infrastructure Fund. Well, the House changed it to come out of road funds, and the Senate's probably going to go along with that. And I'm sorry, Steve, you might not be aware of this, but I think my friends in the Valley will say, I've got Minlars in my head.
Oh, that's an issue in Minnesota. They've got a serious problem there with a computer program that has created nothing but headaches.
Right, and we talked about, you know, some computer problems we've had here, PeopleSoft and the MMIS system, which took longer than it was supposed to because of software glitches and things like that. So.
But what was the governor's issue? I mean, it seems – I know they were talking about effectively doubling the license fee, but $30 in 2019 is not terrible.
I think basically he's just philosophically opposed to raising taxes and
fees.
I think that's right. And I think it's also very interesting because it shows another division between the House and the Senate, which keep kind of creeping into things as we go here.
Okay.
Yes.
The Senate overwhelmingly voted to override the veto.
I believe the House didn't even get enough to the constitutional enough to pass it. If it was just up for passing the first time, it didn't get enough votes to pass.
Well, isn't this just another stream of money for road maintenance and all that?
Yes,
it is.
Well, it would pay the cost of licensing. Right now, what the argument is that the licensing fees don't cover the cost of running the licensing program.
Right. Well, that's a whoops.
Yeah. So the idea was the new fees or additional fees, they wouldn't have to subsidize the licensing process through other road funds.
Right, out of the funds that the highway funds, basically.
Okay. But the House needed a two-thirds vote to override the governor's veto.
Right.
So
Senate got two-thirds, an easy two-thirds, by the way.
Okay, so there's that division again.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
We used to laughingly, and the legislators too, would talk about the red light district. The ones that would vote red on everything.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I do remember, you know, we used to talk about the division between the State House and Senate when Al Carlson was the majority leader, and apparently that division is still there.
Oh, yes. You've got that group of libertarians, too. That they call themselves the Bastiat Caucus.
In the House.
In the House. So you've got that going on there, too.
This is Rick Becker and others,
yes.
Is it? Okay. Let's move on to the story that Daniel had earlier this week about the Senate voting to impose a fine for the sale of e-liquids to minors. What's this about?
The concern is that e-liquids, you know, they're used in e-cigarettes, mm-hmm. vaping, that e-liquids have nicotine. I'm no expert, but I guess there's enough scientific evidence that they do contain some kind of nicotine. Nicotine being considered to be an addictive substance, it's just a gateway thing to get people to smoke. And so they want to keep that out of the hands of the youth at all possible.
I didn't realize it was legal to sell it now to a minor.
I don't know that it is. It's illegal for them to purchase it at a retail establishment. But as I understand it, this bill deals with other adults who buy it and resell it to children.
I think that's correct, yes.
Huh.
But the whole e-cigarette thing is just a developing story as we go. You know, in North Dakota, we still don't – the packages say that it contains nicotine and it's derived from – it's a nicotine-derived product. But we don't tax it like we tax other things. We did have some opportunity for the legislature to do that this year, and I believe they chose not to.
They chose not to, yes.
But we do have this, quote, epidemic of young people using e-cigarettes because it's much more difficult to detect than tobacco smoke.
Well, plus there are all these flavors. It used to be menthol or regular, you know, and now you've
back
got tutti-frutti stuff, and it's crazy. A lot of flavors. That's a discussion nationally as well.
Right. Yeah. The worry is that it's being marketed specifically to younger people.
Well, and the FDA is now looking at some issues too. There are other health issues. It's the marketing for e-cigarettes has been it's not good for you, but it's not as bad as tobacco. So it's an alternative to try and make things less bad for you. But now they're finding all kinds of other things. And I think there was an FDA story this week that talked about that.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the Equal Rights Amendment coming back to haunt the legislature some 40 years later. This was a very interesting story, I thought.
Well, this is very interesting, and I'll go back and I think we mentioned this one time. 1975, I'm a senior in high school, St. Mary's High School in Bismarck, and we were within walking distance of the Capitol. Well, two friends and I went to watch the debate on the Equal Rights Amendment in the House in 1975. We watched the House pass it by just a couple of votes. So I've been involved with this, watching this issue for a while. And, you know, it was ratified in 79. And basically the resolution that was introduced said it expired in 1979 because by that time there was no ratification. This is being pushed by some groups who are saying that, you know, if you pass the Equal Rights Amendment now, it could just lead to more abortion rights and things like that. Heard that, and that was some of the argument on the floor, as a matter of fact. But, you know, if you go back to the 1983 legislature, Senator Holmberg said it passed a measure saying that the 7-year window to have the ERA ratified had expired. But in that resolution, they urged Congress to refile and retry ERA.
It seems like a good way to poke a stick at half the population, to me. And I was intrigued by this quote that you had in your story, Dave, from Senator David Clemens of West Fargo. A lot of people don't even know what sex they are anymore. That caught my eye.
It was amazing, in an amazing debate. Let's just put it – it was an interesting debate.
Okay. Incidentally, I should tell you that Senator Merrill Pepcorn has called into our studio here, and he says that e-liquid cigarette thing we were talking about, he says currently it's against the law to sell it, but it is an infraction and a judge can fine up to $1,000. The bill would make it a Class B misdemeanor with jail and a higher fine possible. So that's what they were getting at there.
Okay. Thanks.
Let's talk about this Theodore Roosevelt Library that the governor wants, that he wants to leverage some money that's apparently on the table, but he needs $50 million from the legacy fund to get the ball rolling. Is that possibly going to come back at the legislature, Dave?
Never say never.
Okay.
I'm serious about that. And we're already talking about some compromises that are being looked at, you know, to make it an endowment fund, not just a $50 million, here's cash, but make it an endowment fund because apparently they think the endowment fund should be enough to get the $100 million that the governor wants to raise in private money to get that thing built.
Steve, do you hear anything about this among your members?
Not so much among the members. I think up at the Capitol, there are still quite a few people who like the idea, I think, and quite a few who don't.
Yes.
And there's really no – you can't pigeonhole people into a particular spot on this. It's some people you might not expect and others who you might expect would. So it is kind of an interesting thing, but it's you know, I think there's a lot of feeling left yet that this is the type of thing, whether this is the right one or not, but this is the type of thing that leaves a legacy, mm-hmm. as the legacy fund was created to do. And others who think there are better, higher priorities. The tough part with that is legacy fund earnings are not going to go to those higher priorities, no matter if they use it for the Roosevelt Library or not.
Matt, does the forum have a position on this?
Yeah, I think we think it's a good idea, and we've seen a lot of letters to the editor and whatnot about this issue. I would say that they're probably running 3-1 in support of this library. So people seem to be liking the idea.
All right. Well, we'll end it with that. And thank you, Matt Von Panani, the editor of the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead. Always a pleasure to have you
with
us in studio. Steve Andrist, a pleasure to have you as well, the executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association. Appreciate your presence today.
Bully.
And thank you. Thanks, TR. And, of course, Dave Thompson, you're a regular on Fridays, and it's great to have you with us on the Prairie Public team.
Hey, thank you, Doug.
More Main Street in a moment.
On our final episode of Threshold.
People should care about the Arctic for many, many reasons. Let's start with ice.
We zoom out and try to see how the Arctic fits into the larger climate change story.
You know, as I tell people, speed kills, and the faster you change... the downsides of climate change are going to manifest themselves.
That's next time on Threshold.
Don't miss the final episode of Season 2 of Threshold on Prairie Public Presents Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain. Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, generating and delivering electricity for 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to the Mexican border.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 5th. After he became president, Teddy Roosevelt established 150 national forests, 51 federal bird reserves, 4 national game preserves, 5 national parks, and 18 national monuments. He preserved 230 million acres of public land for future generations. But while Teddy gets most of the credit for protecting public lands, the movement predated him. President Grant signed the Yellowstone Act in 1872. The act set aside over 1 million acres that would be preserved from injury or spoliation of all timber, mineral deposits, natural curiosities, or wonders within. Yellowstone was the first national park not only in the United States, but anywhere in the world. The efforts to protect public lands did not always run smoothly. Many ranchers, miners, farmers, hunters, and lumbering companies simply ignored the rules. They illegally cut down trees, opened mines, erected fences, and grazed public lands. In 1885, Congress addressed the problem, passing a law authorizing the removal of any illegal structure on public land. Those who wanted to use public lands for their own purposes would not be allowed to use force, threats, intimidation, or any unlawful means to deny access to the public. Although the law was passed in 1885, it was not rigorously enforced. At least it wasn't until Teddy Roosevelt moved into the White House. On this date in 1907, North Dakota newspapers alerted readers to a change in policy. The Washburn Leader warned that small armies of men, armed to the teeth with stump pullers, axes, and other instruments of destruction, would be venturing out to rectify the situation. These men were instructed to remove all fences on public land. The article noted that fences had been prohibited on public land since the law was passed in 1885, but there was an acknowledgement that the law had been enforced only occasionally and in rare spots. But that was no longer the case. The work would continue until every vestige of a fence had been removed. It was estimated that 10,000 workers would be needed to remove thousands of miles of illegal fencing. Teddy said he had been repeatedly approached by cattlemen who sought to leave their fences up for another 6 months or another year. He had finally lost patience, and the fences were coming down. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming, along with our members and other sources, here on Prairie Public.
Monday on Main Street, author Inez Doctor will join us to discuss her book, Prairie Girl Memoir. We'll also have part one of Harvest Public Media's series on the National Bio and Agro Defense Facility. And fossils found in North Dakota have created considerable excitement among paleontologists. Clint Boyd will join us to discuss the findings and the record of mass extinction found in our state. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.